So first off, we're going to look at the setting. One of my favorite classes, again, I love history. So when I look at stuff like this, I go, okay, what's the history behind it? Because when we look at the history and the setting of a situation, of a place, of a thing, we learn a little bit more the why of what someone does. And it's learning in that why that we can have a better idea of why they did what they did and said what they said. So I'm going to give us a little bit of the backstory. Letter A, backstory. Number one, the civil unrest. There has been this Roman era, the Roman Empire, has been called Pax Romana. It's the peace of Rome. And there's an element of peace that did happen throughout Rome because Rome was this huge machine that was in charge, that had a military, an army that could pretty much put down any rebellion, could put down any kind of resistance. And that happened. And it happened multiple times in Israel. Even before Jesus was born, there were multiple uprisings. So there's a civil unrest. We're going to look at letter A, the false messiahs that came before Jesus. This is from Acts 5, 35 through 37. So I'm correlating scripture with this story. It is also confirmed historically through a guy named Josephus, who was a Jew who kept history for the Romans about Jewish history. So there's a couple of different connections there. But what's happening is this is the story that the apostles are brought before the Sanhedrin, that is the ruling class there in the temple, and they're asked, or they're told, you can't talk about Jesus, you need to stop, otherwise we are going to beat you. And so they get beat when they get brought back in again. So they continue to tell him to stop, and Peter says, we can't stop, we can't not talk about our Jesus, so we're going to keep on doing it. And this is part of the response that Gamaliel, one of the Pharisees, one of the scholars, gives. And he quotes, or he references two guys, Thaddeus and Judas. They're both men in Jewish history during the time of Jesus, before Jesus was born, that claimed to be the Messiah. So this isn't a new thing. When we look at Jesus being born to be the Messiah, the anointed one, it wasn't like all of the sudden scripture was revealed to the people and they could all of a sudden believe in this Messiah, Jesus. It was a belief that had been at the core of Jewish belief, of what the Jews were looking ahead to, looking for a Messiah, looking for someone to save them. And so Thaddeus, he led a group of 400 men in revolt against Rome. He claimed to be Christ. What Josephus says of him is that he led these men against Jerusalem. He wanted to cross the Jordan, though, beforehand and prove to the men that he was the Messiah. He said, God will part the Jordan River for us, and we will go across, no problem. And God obviously wasn't with him, because God did not part the river, and a lot of them died drowning because they didn't stop walking when they realized the water wasn't going away. I don't know. That rebellion was also put down after the members scattered. Romans took care of it, because that's what Rome did. The next one, the more significant one really, is Judas the Galilean. He was the founder of the Zealots. He led a revolt during the census. So while Jesus was being born in Bethlehem because of the census, during that time period, this guy named Judas, not Iscariot and not the other disciple named Judas, but a completely different guy, he led a revolt against Rome, tried to take Jerusalem back from Roman rule, and he didn't make it very far because the Romans squashed it. They crucified him. They killed him on a cross, and a handful of his followers as well. Those that remained that were not caught were the group that we call the Zealots. You might recognize that too, because Simon the Zealot was a disciple. The Zealots were known as a group that were continually fighting against Rome. You would get zealots with little knives, daggers. They would walk around the city of Jerusalem, and if they were in a crowd and there was a Roman soldier nearby, they would stab the soldier right between armor plates or whatever and kill him. So that was their kind of resistance. And it was difficult for Rome to find them because they were kind of a terrorist group, really. And that's what they did. Judas was their leader, and so that kind of carried in beyond Judas. And you can bet that King Herod would have had these two guys fresh on his mind when he's being told by Magi that there's a king of the Jews that is going to be born, that there's someone who's going to take over, the Messiah is coming. Herod would have been thinking, oh, I've already dealt with these messiahs before, and I know how to fix it. I'll fix it like Rome fixed it, and I'll get rid of them. I'll kill them. And that's exactly why he reacted like he did to baby Jesus, in addition to the fact that I think he was crazy and probably possessed by Satan to try and thwart God's plan. Because if Jesus couldn't live to adulthood and give his life up for us, then there wouldn't have been that hope. It explains a little. That backstory explains why Herod does what he does, and we'll get to his motivation in a little bit. And the last one, the last example of the false Messiah, is there was an unnamed guy, he's just an Egyptian Jew, who a Roman centurion brings up when he's talking to Paul. And he asks Paul, hey, are you a follower of this Egyptian Jew that came in and said he was the Messiah? And Paul was like, oh no, I am not part of that group. I am not that guy, I'm not part of anything to do with him. Here, let me tell you about Jesus. And so he uses the opportunity to tell the centurion and all of the Jews that were congregated there about Christ and about the true Messiah. That leader that is unnamed, though, was said to have been the leader of 4,000 men who tried to retake Jerusalem, and they lost. It's part of the reason why Pontius Pilate was so willing to crucify Jesus, because there had been a handful of revolutions or revolts up to this point, which showed that Pontius Pilate did not have a good handle on the people, that the leaders in Jerusalem did not have a good handle on the people. And so ultimately, Rome came in 70 AD, around 40 years after Jesus was crucified and rose again, and just completely demolished Jerusalem, made it rubble, flattened it completely. And so that's where you get Jesus, the possibility that he could potentially start another rebellion that was heavy on the mind of Herod while he was dealing with this idea of a new king, of a king of the Jews. So that's the Messiah, the false messiahs. And then we look at civil unrest in B, the power tension. There's a power tension between Rome and King Herod. King Herod is not a Roman. King Herod is an Edomite, that is a descendant of Esau. And if you remember back at the very beginning when God makes his covenant with Abraham, he makes a covenant with Abraham, and through Abraham, Ishmael is born, and Isaac. Ishmael is not the son of promise, not the one that continues the covenant, it's Isaac. Now, Islam would tell you that it's Ishmael, that's a whole other story, but it's through Isaac that God promises that the Jewish line continues. And then from Isaac you have Jacob and Esau, the twins, right? And Esau was born first, and Jacob was born second. They were twins, they were born at the same time, but you get it, right? Esau was supposed to be the son that was given the blessing, but it ended up going to Jacob because Jacob cheated his brother out of it. So the Jews would say, Jacob is our father through Isaac, through Abraham. And the Edomites would say, Esau is our father, and so that's who they followed. So Herod wasn't even a Jew. So to be called the king of the Jews was merely a status symbol. It's something that Rome let him be, but at the same time, the Jews really didn't see him as their king. They used him for their own purposes, their own goals, to keep power in that area. But they definitely didn't accept him into their worship, into their temple, even though he's the reason why the temple was, or he helped build the temple. So there's this tension that's happening throughout this area, locally in Jerusalem, in Israel, in the area, and this power struggle. So number two, we're going to look at global unrest, because that tension goes beyond just that area into the nation surrounding. Rome was obviously the greatest power. To the north of Rome, over in Italy and stuff, you had the Visigoths and the Goths and the other Germanic tribes that eventually came down and raided Rome. But to the east, you had Parthia. You had the remnants of the Persian Empire. They were being ruled by other people, but ultimately they were the other superpower in that area. And Israel basically was the middle ground. So Israel became the battleground for these two nations that would fight against each other. Rome versus, I'll call them Persia or Parthia. At the time it was Parthia. So Rome versus Parthia. And there was this tension, this battle that had occurred a few years before Jesus was born, and there was a tension that maybe Persia or Parthia would try to attack again. It created this idea, or this environment for Herod, this environment for those in Jerusalem that was uneasy. It was tense. It was like, oh, what is going to happen? We don't want this to happen. We don't want to get caught in the crossfire because it won't turn out good for us. So that's the global unrest that is occurring. It's the backstory politically of what's going on in the area. So let's look at B, the location. Because if you ever looked at a play, if you ever looked at the idea of writing a story, you look at the setting and you look, all right, what's the backstory? What has brought us to this point? Like in Romeo and Juliet, there's a backstory of the Capulet versus the Montagues. You don't see a lot of it, but you see the result of it in battles that happen. And you see the result of it in Romeo and Juliet not being allowed to be together and stuff. So this is kind of the backstory to Jesus's to this passage to the Magi. Next, we're going to look at the location. Number one, Israel's role. Specifically, Jerusalem. The Magi show up in Jerusalem first because that is where the seat of power is. That's where King Herod is. That's where the religious leaders are. And so it makes sense that they would go to Jerusalem first, not just show up to Bethlehem when Jesus is born. And the other thing we're going to see is in the prophecy, Bethlehem is named. Bethlehem is a key location because that's where Jesus was born. Because Herod asked the question, well, where is this Messiah to be born? Where is this king to be born? And the scribes say, oh, he's going to be born in Bethlehem. That isn't where the Magi necessarily end up, though. It's part of the process. It's where he would have started and then gone on from there. The Magi do have the star to follow in order to get to where Jesus was. And then Israel had a role in prophecy. Daniel 9:21 through 26, I'll sum it up for you. Basically, the idea that's told is Gabriel, the angel, is delivering a message to Daniel. And he says, know this, understand this, that once or from the time the word goes out to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be, and it says 7 times 70, 67 times 7, a lot of numbers. Basically, here it is, right? There was a known time between when Jerusalem was rebuilt and when the Messiah was supposed to come that was prophesied about in Daniel. And if the Magi had those prophecies or knew of it because they were somehow connected with Daniel, they may have known that there was a Messiah coming anyways. They may have seen that that was part of the deal. That and the huge star in the sky that they followed. But really, the critical role that Israel played was that it was known as the place where the anointed one, the Messiah, was going to be born. The Messiah that was going to save the nation of Israel, that was going to shepherd the nation of Israel. So, Israel's role is key in that. Number two is Herod's Jerusalem. He had the power in Jerusalem. Yes, the power was given to him by Rome, but he made the day-to-day choices. He chose who was going to live and who was going to die. If you remember, his son later made the choice to chop off John the Baptist's head. No Roman stepped in the way of that. They didn't stop him because he was the king in that area. He could do what he wanted to. Herod, again, is King Herod. It's more of a title. He has three sons that his kingdom is divided up for later on. So when Herod is mentioned later, it's not this Herod. This Herod dies within months or years of when he decides to kill all the children under 2 years old, or all the boys under 2 years old. So Herod has complete control. He's rebuilt the temple. He's rebuilt parts of Jerusalem. And while the Jews in Jerusalem enjoyed that, it didn't mean that they liked him because he wasn't one of them. He wasn't a Jew. So that's the background. That's all of the things leading up to this passage that we need to kind of understand and look at because it helps with understanding the story. It helps with understanding the characters and the conversations that happen and what goes on. So if you have your Bibles, hopefully you're in Matthew 2. Let's start out there with verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem, in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed and all Jerusalem with him, because when your king is disturbed and insane, you're disturbed. Sorry, it's disturbing. Never mind. Verse 4. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. In Bethlehem in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written. And this is Micah 5, 2 and 4. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. You notice the term they use is shepherd the people, not rule, not fight against the Romans. It's shepherd the people of Israel. Sorry. Verse 7. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him. After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. So, there isn't a whole lot of talking about where the Magi came from. They came from the east. There's not a whole lot of mystery or magic or anything that goes on in this story. That's all Hollywood. When you look at the story for what it is, you see guys that are watching the stars, that are looking for someone. And those are the Magi. So number two, we're going to look at the characters. Who are the characters in the story? Letter A, first and foremost, we're going to look at the Magi. Number one, who are they? Well, what do we see here? They came from the east. They asked, where is the one who is to be born king of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose, and we've come to worship him. So they are Magi from the east. They're wise men. They're people with wealth because they brought gold, frankincense, and myrrh. They would have come in a group then because three guys on camels coming from the east would have been a really easy target for robbers, for bandits and stuff. So there's got to be more than just three of them. They're wealthy, and they immediately go before the king. So they have some kind of access. They have some kind of authority. If they had come from Parthia, they had come from Persia, to the east, they would have had some form of political clout then. Because if they were the Magi that are spoken of in Daniel and that have been seen as a group of power in Persia, they would have had the authority to name a king. It's a really cool concept, if that's who they actually were. But what we can tell from this story is that they were possibly astrologers or astronomers. They saw a star, they followed the star, and they came to worship the king. They followed to worship the king that was going to be born. So number two, what is the motivation? Why? Why did they do it? They did it because they wanted to worship the Messiah. I don't think that they were looking for political gain. I don't think they were looking for more wealth. I don't think they were looking for power or authority or anything. I think that they genuinely wanted to come and worship the Messiah because this is what they knew. This is what they had heard about. They saw it in the stars. Maybe they knew it from prophecy in Daniel because he had been nearby. Whatever it is, they came to worship the king, to focus on him. And that's where the motivation for the Magi is something that we need to look at and reflect. We need to be like the Magi in going after Jesus, worshiping Jesus, coming to worship him, coming to focus on just him. Not for our own wealth, not for our own ambitions or for our own purposes, but for the purpose of Jesus and getting to know who he is, just like the Magi wanted to know. There's some significance in the gifts that they brought, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Gold obviously uses a currency. It's a valuable metal. It very well could have helped bankroll Joseph and Mary in their retreat down to Egypt when the angel had appeared to Joseph and said, hey, you need to hit the road. Herod is going to be killing babies and Jesus needs to not be here. So they went to Egypt for some time. Frankincense, it's a resin in trees in Africa. It's used for incense or perfume. It is a symbol of offering for sins, right? So the idea is reflected in Jesus being the offering for the sins of the world. This idea that the frankincense kind of foreshadows the offering that Christ would be for mankind. And then myrrh, again, has a very similar symbol. The idea that it was used to embalm bodies. In fact, when Jesus was crucified and laid in the tomb, the women brought spices and myrrh to go and embalm him. Obviously, they found it empty because Jesus rose again. But myrrh was kind of a foreshadowing of the death that Jesus would possibly suffer. So while it's cool and it's nice that they brought him gifts, ultimately God kind of used it, Matthew kind of used it here, as a foreshadowing of what was to come. And the suffering and the death of Christ, definitely not a cheery thing, but if it wasn't for that, we'd be pretty hopeless here now, because Jesus did it for us. So, letter B, let's look at the two kings. The first one, King Herod. Who was he? Who was King Herod? From here, we can see that he's willing to lie. He tries to deceive the Magi, because King Herod doesn't want to go see Jesus to worship him. He wants to go see Jesus to get rid of the competition. He wants to go kill baby Jesus. He was willing to order, and he did, order that all boy children 2 years and under were to be killed. That is insane. Legitimately crazy. He was a paranoid, self-serving tyrant. He was not interested in loving those that he ruled. He was interested in controlling them. He was a ruler that was purely out for himself, so much so that he did help, or he commanded the slaughter of hundreds, if not thousands, of children in Jerusalem and the outlying area in Israel. He was cunning, he was cruel, and if he didn't get his way, if he didn't get what he wanted, he removed whatever kept that from happening. And that's what he tried to do with Jesus. B, motivation. What is his motivation? Why? All right, well, not to justify any of his actions, of course, but because he's paranoid, because he has no idea how insane he was and everything, part of the reason why he would have had those children killed is because he didn't want that competition. So he was selfish. He was motivated by what he wanted. He wanted to put down those resistances. He also may have been a little worried, because if the Magi were from the east and they may have been connected with a greater kingdom, that kingdom could have infiltrated and attacked Israel or Rome, and Israel would have been the target. He could have been paranoid of that as well. Either way it goes, Herod's motivation is evil, and it is selfish and horrible. But let's look at the second king. Who is he? Number two, baby Jesus. Right? Baby Jesus is the second king in this story. Baby Jesus is... Well, and I'll just talk, just call him Jesus, because, again, in the story, we don't know if he was newborn, we don't know if he was 2 years old. That theory happens because Herod wanted to make sure that all the babies were killed just in case. God very well could have put a star in the sky, or could have led the Magi there before Jesus was even born to get them there, so that he would be there around the time. Were they in Bethlehem? I don't know. Were they in Nazareth? I don't know. We don't know because it doesn't tell us. They were directed to Bethlehem, but ultimately, we don't know where they went. They just followed the star. They followed where God led them, and they ended up at wherever Jesus was. And it says they found Mary and the child in a house, so we can tell that they're at least out of the manger. They're at least out of the cave where Mary gave birth to him. So whether that's in the inn that they were turned away from, or whether that's at home in Nazareth and Galilee, we don't know. And I don't think it really matters, because the Magi weren't about getting there or whatever. They were about the goal and the king himself, Jesus. So, who is he? Who is Jesus? He's the Messiah. He's the anointed one. I wish that I had time to go through every single one of these, but obviously we'd be here until the end of time and we'd miss that Seahawks game and stuff. So, he's the one that's foretold about in prophecy. He appears in the Old Testament at times as the angel of the Lord, or, you know, as Jesus, or as God in human form there. He's also foreshadowed about in the Old Testament. All of this prophecy, appearance, and foreshadowing happens 414 times throughout the Old Testament. There are prophecies throughout the Old Testament that if one person fulfilled, like the number, the mathematical number is something I can't even explain because I don't understand it. But the probability of someone fulfilling all these prophecies is mathematically impossible, or at least improbable, except that all things are possible with God. Except that because God is the creator and God is the one who really just planned it all and made it all happen, we know it's true because he did that. Also, there are prophecies about Jesus that he had absolutely no control over. Like, Jesus being born in Bethlehem, do you think Jesus tried to be born in Bethlehem? No. Well, I guess, never mind. No, he didn't. All right. The prophecy about Herod killing babies, right? It's talked about. A voice was heard in Ramah weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. That's a prophecy about his decision to kill the babies in Jeremiah, right? And there are so many more that he was from the line of David, that he, born of a virgin, you know, all these things. For one of them to line up is believable, but for all of them to line up together, even outside of his control, even outside of his influence, the disciples had prophecies that were written years before in Isaiah that span thousands of years, that span hundreds, thousands of miles, that span time and space. It's impossible, except that it's true and God did it and made it happen. All right? So Jesus is the Word. He was with God. He is God. He was with God in the beginning. That's who he is. And his motivation, why Jesus? Why did he come? John 3:17, God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. The Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. It's in Luke. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repent. Jesus says it in Luke also, 5:32. I lay down my life so that I may take it up again. No one has taken it away from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative. This is John 10. Jesus gave up his life for us. And then the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus paid the price. That was his motivation, his love for us and who he is. And if it isn't for him, we don't have hope. We don't have salvation. And the Magi, following the star, understood the importance of this king. They didn't know what he was going to do yet, but they knew that he needed to be worshipped. And they're really the closest connector that we have with who we are, because the Magi were not Jews. They didn't necessarily have the same kind of prophecies that the Jewish people were looking forward to as they looked forward to the Messiah, but rather they were outsiders that came in that worshiped Jesus. We're outsiders. We're outside of the Jewish Hebrew nation, and we're coming in to the family. We're being a part of it, worshiping Jesus if we believe in him. So it's just a cool connection that we share with the Magi. So that's who Jesus is. That's his motivation, why he came. Let's look at the temple officials. Who are they? Temple officials are chief priests. They're teachers of the law. These are guys that knew Scripture so well that when Herod came to them and said, "Where is the one who is to be born king of the Jews?" When he asked them that question, they didn't have to like go get their scrolls and unravel it and go, "Let's see here, Isaiah. Is it here?" No. They would have like had it memorized. They would have immediately went, "All right, here we go. But Bethlehem in the land of Judah are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. Out of you will come a ruler." So they knew that's where it was going to happen. And they told Herod right away. But what about number two? What about their motivation? What was the temple officials' motivation? What were they trying to accomplish? I would suggest, if the temple officials were looking for the Messiah and hoping for the Messiah, I would suggest that if they wanted to know who Jesus was, if they wanted to be led by someone, they would have went with the Magi and worshiped Jesus too. But where are they? They're staying in Jerusalem. They're staying at their temple. They're not going to greet this new Messiah who has been promised. They want to hang on to their power. They want to hang on to their authority. And so they are staying put because they're more interested in the kind of heart that Herod has than the kind of heart that Jesus had. They want to follow King Herod instead of King Jesus. And that was the heart of the officials. And that's the heart that runs through the entire Gospels. It's the heart of the officials that chose to put Jesus on a cross. that chose to crucify him and to push their own will because they didn't want Jesus taking that authority from them. Just like when he was a baby, they didn't want him taking that authority as a grown man. And it was all part of God's plan in the end, though, so that he could give his son up for us so that we could be saved, so that we could have new life. Number three, well, let's look at the purpose. So we've seen the setting. We've seen the characters, everyone in this passage. Let's look at the purpose. Why does Matthew include it? Why do we need to be reading it? Why do we need to be looking at it? Letter A, being like Herod. And by being like Herod, I mean don't be like Herod. Herod is, in this story, an exact representation of the worst possible person you can be. I mean, this guy had thousands of kids killed. This guy wanted to kill Jesus. This guy was lying and deceiving, and he was in control of everything and kept his power and authority and was selfish about it. If we, taking the example of Herod, allow ourselves to become like that, to be driven by selfish ambition, to be driven by what we want or hanging on to our own power or authority, and if we allow that to occur, we become no better than Herod. And Herod is not a good example. When you tell your kids bedtime stories, you don't say, hey, be like King Herod, right? No, quite the opposite. Which is letter B. What's the purpose? What about the Magi? Being like the Magi. Again, here are men that are outside of Jerusalem, that are outside of prophecy, that are outside of the belief or the knowing of who Jesus was going to be. And they see a star in the sky. They hear God calling to them someday through a star, and they start following, all right? And they start going after this Messiah, this king that they don't really know a whole lot about. They just know that there's someone that's there. It's very reflective or very, it looks a lot like Abraham, right? God calls Abraham out of the land of Ur and then says, I'm gonna take you to a new place and you need to listen to me. And he listens. The Magi do the same. We need to be like the Magi. Their motivation was to worship Jesus, was to worship the Messiah. In the same way, not just paying lip service, we need to worship Jesus through our words, through our lives. And then like the Magi, they gave gifts to Christ, right? They gave him gold, frankincense, and myrrh. I'm not saying that you need to like somehow acquire myrrh and then throw it in the offering or anything like that, or that you somehow can give myrrh back. The idea here is that we need to be giving of ourselves, whether it's our talent, our time, whatever it is, we need to be giving back to Jesus. We need to be worshiping him in that way. Because this worship is one of submission. It's one of adoration. It's adoring Christ. It's adoring who he is. And then it's giving back to him. It's self-sacrificing. Because he is our divine king. And even though at this point Jesus had no power in the sense that he had any earthly authority, he was a baby, he was a child. That didn't stop the Magi from worshiping him. You know, we can worship a Christ. We should worship Jesus just like they did. Let's look at the applications, which are the first one here. Just like the shepherds come to bow down and worship, or just like the shepherds came to bow down and worship, so too did the Magi. We're to bow down and worship our one true King, the ruler of heaven and earth, the Lord of lords, the King of kings. Just because Christmas is over, it doesn't mean we need to stop allowing the heart of worship or focusing on our King to end. We need to keep doing it. Keep focusing on Jesus. It doesn't just happen once a year where we get to celebrate his birth, but throughout the entire year, we can look back on that and then look ahead to Easter, right? To salvation, to the cross. Number two, don't be like Herod. That's pretty simple, but don't allow yourself to be controlled by selfish ambition. Don't let your desire for power and wealth and authority control your heart. Allow love to, allow kindness, allow humility, the humility of Christ to fill your hearts. Be like him, be like the Magi, not like Herod. And then last, remember, the Bible's great on its own, right? We don't need to add any flourishes to it. That's how heresy comes in. That's how false teaching infiltrates the church and infiltrates our theology. But just letting the Magi be who they are and understanding they came to worship Jesus is enough. We don't need to give them names. We don't need to give them superpowers or anything. They're just fine the way they are.